Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. Today I'm having one of my favorite guests on, Dr. Richard Amerling, to come back and speak in more detail about a lot of things, including the treatment for the major chronic diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure. I think everybody's been paying a lot of attention to the cost of the pharmaceuticals and the fact that it's completely gotten out of control. Whatever they do with the reform effort, which I'm personally not thinking they're going to do a thing except keep the status quo, we need to start taking control of our health. And I think I've spoken about it many times before that the standard of care has changed from the time that I was a medical student and resident. What constituted disease, the parameters have gotten more, I guess, restricted. So what was normal before is now pre-something, or you actually have the disease. And I know my personal theory on this is the more people that you can diagnose, more medications you can dispense, and it keeps the whole beast fed. But I wanted an expert to come on today and speak more about it. And Dr. Amerling is a nephrologist. He was the former president of American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, and I'm sure he's still a member. And now he's a professor in Grenada at St. George's Medical School, isn't it?
Yes.
And you are on the front line, and I have to say what you do is yeoman's work because you are bringing the next generation of physicians online, and I'm not sure I like what I've been seeing on the stateside, so I'm sure we want to get into that again about what you're seeing now that you've had some time to teach students. What are you seeing on the front line?
Well, there has been massive contamination of medical education by what's referred to as evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And therein lies the problem. And unless we can dissect what this term has come to mean and try to figure it out, we're going to be pushed more and more to prescribe as opposed to counsel and treat by natural diet and exercise and the things that we know work.
Mm-hmm.
I'd highly recommend a book that I read some years ago called Tarnished Gold, The Sickness of Evidence-Based Medicine by Steve Hickey and Hillary Roberts. I think it was published in 2011 or so. And it's a item-by-item dissection of this whole movement of so-called evidence-based medicine. Another excellent article would be a recent editorial by John Ioannidis called Evidence-Based Medicine Has Been Hijacked. And you can easily find these. And John also has some YouTube lectures where he covers this topic in detail.
Mm-hmm.
And I recommend those as well. And briefly, the problems with so-called evidence-based medicine is, first of all, the name, because it suggests that before the whole EBM movement started, that we were just practicing by whim and by superstition, you know, and that is certainly not true. We've been practicing scientific medicine for many decades before EBM came along. And then they have this hierarchy of evidence where they are arbitrarily ordering evidence into a pile with the double-blind randomized controlled trial at the top and anecdotal experience at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anecdotal experience is what differentiates experienced clinicians from interns, from people who are just starting out. It's accumulated experience with patients over many years that adds to their ability to not only diagnose but to treat. And if that were not true, then everybody would be fine just being taken care of by a brand new graduate as opposed to somebody with 10 or 20 or 30 years of clinical experience. And we know that, that's not true. So this whole idea that clinical experience and so-called anecdotal evidence is unimportant, really, and can be dismissed is a major problem. Because you can learn a lot from individual experience with one patient. For example, let's say somebody takes a certain medication, develops a bad rash. You stop the medication, the rash goes away, and then you put him back on it, you challenge him again, he gets the rash again. Well, you've established beyond any sort of a reasonable doubt that that patient has an allergy to that rash. You didn't need a double-blind controlled study. The patient essentially was his own control. And this is what we do every day in medicine. Mm-hmm. So we have a very scientific approach based on our understanding of pathophysiology and disease, natural history, and we apply this to patients, and we give them treatments that are also based on understanding of disease mechanisms as much as possible, understanding of pharmacology and how drugs work, and monitor their response and adjust as necessary. So that is highly scientific approach to treating patients and has nothing to do with EBM. So now EBM has been hijacked by the industry. Why? Because they're the only ones who are capable of mounting these very large randomized controlled trials. Mm-hmm. And then they say, and the EBM acolytes say, well, you know, yes, you say that diet is very effective in type 2 diabetes. Well, what's the evidence for that? I said, well, I've got, 40 patients in my practice who've responded extremely well to diet and have come off their medication. I said, well, that's not evidence. That's just your anecdotal experience. And they poo-poo it. But it's extremely valid. And all the studies that are done are really looking at various levels of glycemic control, using surrogate endpoints such as the hemoglobin A1C or cholesterol lowering and all this stuff. And the results that they produce are extremely poor or minimal at best. And they amplify these by having large studies so that your p-value becomes significant with a trivial improvement in the relative risk of whatever complication you're looking at. But those are the studies that make up the basis of so-called modern practice, which is very aggressive treatment of LDL cholesterol, very aggressive treatment of hemoglobin A1C, very aggressive treatment of systolic and diastolic blood pressure, even in the elderly, with, I think, very bad results. I mean, looking at across the board, we haven't really been making major strides, and we are probably harming a lot of patients by over-treating them.
That's been one of my pet peeves, is we're putting patients on more and more medications, but they're not getting better. They're getting sicker.
Right.
And now we're seeing the side effects, really present themselves with the statin drugs, for example, and heart disease or cardiac problems, and having to add coenzyme Q. I think most clinicians, well, I hope most clinicians at this point know they need to add that supplement because there is a risk of worsening or creating a condition that you're not even treating by using these statin drugs.
Right.
And it's like playing catch-up and chasing your tail. I don't know if you saw this. A couple of days ago, I ran across an article about a peer-reviewed articles, I wouldn't say majority, but a fair amount were found to be fraudulent because they weren't peer-reviewed. Did you see that article?
No, I didn't see it. But John Ioannidis wrote a heavily quoted paper about this where he said that the vast majority of scientific literature is unlikely to represent reality. I mean, it's unlikely to be true, in other words.
Isn't that sad?
He's right. And, of course, there is all this pressure to publish, and you only get to publish a study if it's positive, so the design of the study is rigged so that it will always be positive. And the literature becomes corrupt and biased, so you can't even really look at the literature and say with confidence that that's going to be a guide to your treatment. And that's another problem with the evidence-based medicine, which is that they're all population studies, and that doesn't really tell you enough about how to treat an individual patient.
It's very true.
It doesn't have enough detail, doesn't have enough information.
Well, even the difference between patients, I mean, they don't really do studies on children or minority populations, and so not everybody responds the same way to a medication. You know, I see a lot of patients who come into my practice who are black patients on the ACE inhibitors, you know, like lisinopril, et cetera.
Right.
I mean, and I've heard, and you can correct me because this is your territory completely, is that cohort of patient a little bit more susceptible to the side effects of that type of medication?
Yeah, and they don't typically respond as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there are these genetic differences. There are probably some cultural differences as well. And there are individual differences, as you say, and the companies tend to generalize from one study and extrapolate to larger and larger populations without having the evidence even to do that. You know, the majority of diabetes studies are on relatively young adults or middle-aged adults, and yet they push those recommendations for glycemic control into the elderly population, where they clearly cannot possibly benefit. I mean, you know, someone who's 75 or 80 is not going to benefit by having a hemoglobin A1C of 6.5 or even 7, whereas they may drop from a hypoglycemic episode, which occur with increasing frequency the lower you push the hemoglobin A1C.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very bad model. It's abused flagrantly, you know, this generalization across different populations. And it's gotten totally out of hand. So, you know, I'm trying to teach down here as much as I can for the new doctors to be thinking for themselves and to use their brain and use their knowledge of pathophysiology and pharmacology and all the basic sciences that they've worked so hard to acquire to guide their treatment, and don't be misled by these panel-based recommendations because they're not reliable.
Well, you know, I always say follow the money. I mean, you look at who underwrites these studies. They're drug companies, and it's amazing what you come up with. Their findings are usually, you know, skewed and beneficial towards whatever product they're hawking. And what happened to conflict of interest? What happened to, you know, the scientific method? I don't understand that. I mean, I kind of do, because you have all this money floating around in medical schools, in hospital settings. There's a website, I can't remember what it is, but you can go on it and see how much money each hospital makes in this country, research money. And it is astounding the amount of money that flows through the hospital setting for research purposes. You know, in order to keep that gravy train going, what do? You know, who stands to gain?
It's true. The bias in literature is largely because of these industry-funded studies. They also, of course, advertise in all the major journals, and they have a lot of control, I believe, over the content of the journals. There are lots of articles that Marcia Angel has written about this, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. It's been out there. It's not like this is some unknown topic. It's very obvious, and it's sort of almost in your face how obvious it is. And the panelists of many of the influential guideline committees are heavily financed by industry. You just have to go to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute webpage to discover that for yourselves. And how can you possibly accept these recommendations when you know that these people are making majority of their income from consulting, speaking, research grants, et cetera. It's not like it's a small amount. They don't publish the amounts, of course, but, you know, I know what academics earn, and it's not a lot. So I know that these monies coming in from industry are a huge part of their total pay. And how can they not be conflicted? I mean, it's just against human nature to think that they're going to be unbiased. And the bias is plain to see if you just read the text of what these guidelines and recommendations say. Mm-hmm. For example, the notion that there is no LDL cholesterol too low cannot possibly be true. I mean, why would the body produce this stuff?
That's
of course,
sick.
There isn't just one LDL cholesterol. Everybody now knows this, or people should know it. And cholesterol is extremely important for not only brain and nerve function, but also, you know, look at the metabolic pathway for synthesis of cholesterol. I actually have it up on my wall in an old poster, the biochemical pathways. And the HMGA-CoA reductase is right at the very beginning of the biosynthesis of cholesterol. And it also interferes with the synthesis of CoQ10, which is a major problem. All of the tocopherols, vitamin E's, vitamin A's, all come out of that pathway after the level of blockade by HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors. All of the steroid hormones come from cholesterol, including the sex hormones. How can it possibly be good to inhibit biosynthesis of this extremely vital compound in our body? It just can't be. If you just look at the biochemistry of it, you will conclude that this is not the way to go. This cannot be a good approach. And the truth is, it isn't. It isn't. We've been in the statin era now for about 20 years or so.
Yeah.
Where is the improvement? I mean, if anything, there's more heart failure now than there used to be.
Yeah, erectile dysfunction, heart failure, problems with everything, thyroid, women's issues. The list is kind of endless. On that note, let's take a small break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're speaking today with Dr. Richard Amerling, a nephrologist and a professor, and, you know, someone important in keeping us attuned and abreast of really what the truth is in healthcare. Medicine has become a corporatized business, and I think patients and doctors have been monetized. We're just grist for this mill. That's what they would like us to be. And in the break, I was telling my producer, that I think that the whole goal is to keep somebody on more than one medication, the more the better, every day, for as long as you can get it, until they become a senior, and then you just withdraw the treatment because they're too expensive. I mean, that's what it seems like to me. What's your take on that?
Well, no, they keep them on even as a senior, and they're sometimes being harmed. In fact, I was talking with a colleague who runs a hospice, and one of the things that they do when someone enters hospice care is they withdraw a lot of the medication, and patients get better.
Isn't that sad? Really? Oh, my goodness.
The mortality improves under hospice care, amazingly enough.
Wow.
And I'm convinced it's because they withdraw toxic medications that are not doing any good. No, there's a lot of money and a lot of corruption out there. You know, the statin thing, people have said it's like the mafia. You know, you don't agree with them, you sort of get marginalized. But it's like the mafia, except stakes are much higher. You know, right? There are many more hundreds of billions of dollars at stake with these drugs than anything the mafia had ever dreamed of. But the big, it's not just pharma, you know, it's the food industry.
Yeah.
And I want to alert you and your listeners to a case that has just concluded in South Africa. Everybody should be aware of this. Why? Because it's really, I think, the future of what's going to be happening here as well. One of the leading physicians in South Africa, Professor Tim Noakes, N-O-A-K-E-S, was charged with unprofessional behavior because in a tweet, he mentioned to a woman that he felt that weaning off of breastfeeding should use high quality, high protein and fat food. In other words, low carb, high fat, which is of course the way to go in terms of diet these days. And he got castigated by a dietitian, and she complained to the medicine regulatory agency in South Africa, and they brought him up on charges, and he fought it, and he underwent a Spanish Inquisition of sorts, where he defended his position. I understand he just won the case, which was great, but it attracted international attention because this is so chilling, of course, that a physician could be brought up because of an opinion. And it wasn't even really a patient. It was just an opinion of his that he expressed in a tweet. But I recommend his website, Tim Noakes. You can find him easily on Google. There's a lot of stuff about it. Read about this trial. Marina Skorbos wrote about it and did a lot of investigation behind it. And you see that the dietary authorities in South Africa are not only funded by, but actually paid directly in some instances by the sugar industry there.
Wow.
So, of course, they're soft-pedaling the risks of sugar, and this happened in our country, too. There was recently a story about an article that appeared in the 60s in the New England Journal of Medicine that was a authored study about sugar versus fat in terms of cardiovascular risk. And, of course, that was the hot debate back then. And the fat, of course, won, and that's how we got the low-fat diet through Ansel Keys' efforts. This study was actually funded by the sugar industry. The sugar lobby paid the authors of the study a grant to do this paper. This was never revealed, of course, by the New England Journal of Medicine. They just published it as an unbiased review article that laid the blame for heart disease at the foot of dietary fat as opposed to sugar. And think about the millions of lives that have been shortened or impaired or just cut off by our dietary recommendations that came out in the 1980 to decrease our consumption of fat, increase carbohydrates as a natural result. And this is when the epidemic of obesity started in the United States. You could see it very clearly. And type 2 diabetes as a result. And this was pushed by the sugar lobby with the help of certain doctors and official organizations. The American Heart Association jumped on this bandwagon. And who's ever going to say, I'm sorry? You know, who's ever going to be held accountable for what must have been one of the most egregious errors of public health policy ever? And it's still being soft-pedaled or hushed up, and the word is getting around thanks to the internet and word of mouth, and people are simply changing their diet, and they're curing their diabetes and getting off medication.
It's astounding, the explosion of type 2 diabetes in the last 15 years, 20 years. It was, you have children with it now. You know, yep. There's got to be an issue here. I mean, how do pediatricians, how does anybody who is a thinking physician just get on the bandwagon of give them a hypoglycemic medication, just put them on metformin or whatever, instead of trying to figure out why? It's not the simple answer. It's never the simple answer. What are you putting in your mouth, and are you moving? That doesn't seem to be the case. It's just drug somebody. And I'm hoping, and I think I'm seeing a change a bit, where patients are not wanting just to take a medication. They now want to fix the problem. Have you seen that in your practice and your experience?
Yeah. I mean, people are extremely open to getting off medication. And if you are a practicing physician, you're going to have a lot of happy patients if they leave your office taking fewer medications than when they came in. They're going to be happy because they don't want to take all these pills, number one. And number two, they will feel better. The more medicines you get them off, the better they feel, in my observation. And you can treat most of these so-called chronic diseases with diet and lifestyle. And when you think about it, the major disease of our time is not type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is a late manifestation of the insulin resistance syndrome or the metabolic syndrome. And that starts 10, 15 or so years before you actually develop overt diabetes. So physicians ought to be targeting this disease by looking at waist circumference and looking at diet and perhaps doing a glucose tolerance test, which is much more sensitive than hemoglobin A1C or random blood sugar. Looking at insulin levels. You know, insulin levels should be extremely low. You should be walking around with almost undetectable insulin levels. If your insulin levels are high, you've got insulin resistance almost by definition. So it has to change the approach, and we've got to change our approach early on. And part of it, of course, is teaching and this unfortunate name that we gave this disease of type 2 diabetes, because then the treatment paradigm for type 1 diabetes automatically gets applied to it.
Yeah.
And that is an incredibly big mistake.
You know, Richard, for the listeners, because you and I are speaking shorthand, I want them to understand what metabolic syndrome is. If you're sitting listening to this podcast or the show now, what are you looking for? What does the patient or the listener need to think about when you say metabolic syndrome?
Yeah, metabolic syndrome was first described by a physician, Gerard Reven, where he noticed that people had a triad, more or less, of symptomatology and signs related to central obesity. They had central obesity. They also tended to have hypertension. They often developed type 2 diabetes, and they had cardiovascular disease. So this became known as the metabolic syndrome, otherwise known as syndrome X. And they had a typical lipid pattern as well, where their triglycerides were high. Their LDL was neither here nor there, but their HDL, so-called good cholesterol, was low.
Mm.
So when you get a lipid profile and you see this pattern, then that helps you to identify patients with metabolic syndrome. And interestingly, these patients were segregated out and not even really studied in most of the statin trials. But of course, statins don't work particularly on these patients because their LDLs aren't even that high.
Right.
And their HDL being low and triglycerides high confers them tremendous cardiovascular risk. But neither of those are really addressed by statin therapy. The only thing that improves that lipid profile in these patients is a low-carb diet. And if you put these folks on the low-carb diet, and I say now low-carb, high-fat. And this has been a change in the last few years in my direction. I've always believed that fat is not problematic, just by personal experience with my own diet and also other patients that I've been taking care of. And fat has a lot of other advantages, the major one being that you don't eat much when you're eating fat. A moderate fat meal is very satisfying and keeps you from being hungry. If you have a low-fat diet, you're hungry all the time, and this is one of the major problems with that approach. So this idea that fat calories are what make you fat is simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
And fat is metabolized very differently from glucose, and glucose is metabolized differently even from fructose. And the fructose content of our diet is an extremely important problem. The high fructose diets that we're seeing with high fructose corn syrup and lots of sucrose being added to virtually everything,
mm-hmm.
are what is largely responsible for this epidemic of metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, and obesity. And I instruct patients to look at labels to be sure not to buy products where they're adding this stuff. You have to stick with whole natural foods without added sugar, and you will slim down. And if you eat good, healthy fat, you will slim down. You will eat much less, and you'll be much healthier.
Well, let's take a break on that point and come back and investigate or get more specific about what you think good fat is. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're speaking with Dr. Richard Amerling, and before the break, you were getting into a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, but I want folks to understand what you say is a good fat, because they're not all created equal. I mean, it's not McDonald's or Kentucky Fried Chicken, I'm quite sure.
Well, those products are tainted not by fat, but by carbs, of course, all the breaded stuff that they put on there. And this whole push to unsaturated fat was It was a bad road to be taking. Unsaturated fats, which are unstable at high temperature, are not good for cooking. They become unstable. They are broken down. The fatty acid content is broken down into aldehydes, which are toxic. So saturated fats, such as butter, are healthy. I eat it every day. I start my day with usually bacon and eggs and a little bit of bread, a baguette, sugar-free, of course, right? Mm-hmm. I will never buy a bread that has added sugar. To me, adding sugar to bread is sort of a sin. You know, why destroy this actually beautiful food with sugar? So that meal typically carries me through to dinner. It is so filling and so satisfying that I typically don't really even get hungry around lunchtime. I may have a small bag of cashew nuts or walnuts or something like that if I get hungry. And then for dinner, I have either steak or pork or grilled fish in butter. I like butter. French butter, in fact, is my, you know, I go out of my way to get it. So I don't even look at my cholesterol anymore. It's always been high. My cholesterol has always been in the 200s, high 200s. Mm-hmm. And I've had a couple of coronary calcium scans with no coronary artery calcium. And I decided this is simply not the right approach. You know, this has nothing to do with health. Health has to do with having a good balanced diet and not having insulin resistance. If you avoid insulin resistance, you're going to be healthy for the most part. Mm-hmm. So that's how you do it. You just have very little carbohydrate intake. I mean, I eat some fruit, not a lot, and my salads, you know, I enjoy salad with olive oil and vinegar, you know. Mm-hmm. And all whole foods. I don't get processed food at all. I just don't get it.
Well, I'm sure your inflammation is cut way down with this type of diet.
I mean, my weight is, I weigh what I weighed 25 years ago.
If we could all say that, huh?
You know, it's interesting. I've been reading a lot of blogs. One that I can recommend is Werner's Views, Werner Wheelock, V-E-R-N-E-R-W-H-E-E-L-O-C-K.com. He has lots of very informative articles about diet. He's British. They're fighting this fight over in the UK because the official dietary recommendations still allow for way too much carbohydrates and way too much sugar. Again, probably influenced by industry. And so he's a voice out there and very good information, excellent articles that are referenced, looking at all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So check him out. What did you want to, what was your last question? Did you have something else?
Well, yeah, actually, let's...
Wondering.
No, that's quite right.
Yeah, okay.
Let's talk about salt, because that's another thing that we've been just hijacked. You know, if you have salt, you're going to die.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know the salt that we're getting now is no longer iodized. I mean, it's got bromine, it's not a normal halogen that's in it. So from an ENT standpoint, I think it's blocking our thyroid and giving us, you know, I've seen goiter come back because of no iodine. It's a huge problem. And I don't even eat the regular table salt anymore because of that. But, you know, in the scheme of things, salt itself, is it such a sin to have salt, or do we really need it? Are we in a position now where the salt that we're taking in is not enough?
I think the latter. I mean, I think, of course, salt is required for life.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been recognized as such. It's the basis of the word salary is from salt. And because it was so valuable as being necessary to preserve life. If you are on a zero salt intake, eventually your blood pressure will collapse and you'll die. So you need to replace salt that is lost. And now you can, your kidney, healthy kidney can reclaim almost every little bit of salt that passes through it. So you won't lose a whole lot through the kidney, but you will lose it through the skin. So sweat contains anywhere from, you know, none to a gram of salt per liter. So if you're out exercising in a hot climate, you're going to be going through a lot of salt. Now, the 1 to 2 gram intake that is now becoming officially recommended, first of all, makes food very unappetizing. You know, the flavor of food is greatly enhanced by a moderate amount of salt. And I just think it's inadequate for most people. And when I look at a patient, I do a very careful assessment of their volume status with measurement of their jugular vein pressure, the central venous pressure. And I'm increasingly seeing that it's low, even in people who are hypertensive. So if you salt deplete a youngish person, sometimes their blood pressure actually goes up because you're activating their sympathetic nervous system. As a way to respond to the low salt status.
Right.
You're activating their renin-aldosterone system. These are hormones that the kidney produces to help retain salt. So people are walking around now with activated sympathetic nervous systems, renin-aldo systems, angiotensin II, which cannot be healthy. And in fact, there is a U-shaped curve for mortality with salt intake. And at the low end, mortality goes up as well as at the high end. So moderate salt intake, I would say 4 to 5 grams a day is recommended. Otherwise, you are at risk of being salt depleted. And the average person who doesn't have high blood pressure, doesn't have heart failure, doesn't have kidney failure, doesn't have liver failure, they don't have a problem with salt. If they take in a little bit more one day, their kidneys get rid of it.
Right.
Right? So it's not a health hazard. And to broadly prescribe this through public policy is a major error along the lines of the low-fat diet recommendations. It's going to cause disease. I'm seeing it already. And, you know, as another side effect of this, I've been getting these little bags of cashew nuts sometimes locally at the store here as my little snack at lunchtime. And one of the reasons I like it is because it's got salt, and it's harder and harder to get salt in anything at this point. Well, I got some the other day, and I'm eating them, and I'm saying, what the hell is going on here? This stuff tastes like crappy. I mean, I used to like this. What happened? Well, they took a lot of the salt out. So not only do you eat more because you need the salt, right? You're eating this stuff because, for the salt, for the most part, because your body needs it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a certain salt sensing system, which we must have, you know, there's no question we have it, then you're going to take in the amount of salt you need. But if you're taking the salt out of, let's say, nuts or pretzels, you're going to eat twice as many of them. So this is going to have a rebound effect, an unintended consequence of increasing obesity, because people are going to be eating more of these foods to get the salt that they need. And I wrote an email to the company. I said, you know, I used to be a big fan of your cashew nuts until you took the salt out. Now I'm not getting them anymore.
It's funny. It's a real domino effect, huh? I mean,
yeah.
One thing just tips over the other, and next thing you know, you're in someone's office and you're not feeling good, or you're gaining weight for no reason. And, you know, I just wanted to revisit the metabolic syndrome again, just briefly. I think one of the things that you can tell that you have it, not only are you having, you know, your weight gain in the central part of your body, but it's impossible to lose weight. So, you know, you do everything, you exercise, you cut your calories, but you're not losing weight. To me, that's one of the a clinical sign that you may have metabolic syndrome. Is that something that you have seen?
Absolutely. In fact, Tim Noakes, who I referred to earlier, writes about how he discovered this, and it was on his own personal health. He is a runner. I mean, he's written a lot about exercise physiology. He's a very knowledgeable guy, and he discovered he could not lose 10 or 15 pounds that he needed to get into running shape. And he checked a glucose tolerance test, and he found out that he was insulin resistant.
Mm.
So that's what got him onto a low carb diet, and he then lost the 10 or 15 pounds, and he got back into running, and he improved his times and all this stuff. So yes, it is this whole idea, and this is something that needs to be debunked thoroughly, of that the human body behaves like a calorimeter is completely wrong. In other words, that if you consume a certain number of calories and don't burn them in terms of your exercise, then you're going to gain weight. Mm-hmm. And the only way to lose weight is to consume fewer calories or burn more. That is certainly not true. And this has been one of the reasons why fat has become demonized, because, of course, in a calorimeter, you burn a gram of fat, you produce 9 kilocalories, as opposed to 4 kilocalories from a gram of carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm.
So that fueled this whole craze for carbs and demonization of fat. But fat is handled metabolically much differently, as is protein. Protein actually requires energy to burn. So you actually, you know, use about 10 or 15% of the energy content of protein just to metabolize it. And fat goes through fatty acid synthesis, fatty acid metabolism pathways, which burn clean CO2 and water, an incredibly good energy source for muscle use and, to fuel our mitochondria. They'd be very happy just burning fat constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely efficient way to burn energy. And fat storage, however, depends on insulin. You need high insulin levels to store fat. And this is what carb intake does. It raises your insulin level. If the carbohydrate that is converted to glucose by the systems in the body, metabolic pathways, digestive systems, if that glucose is not burned immediately as energy or stored as glycogen, and by the way, that doesn't really happen much because we typically don't use our glycogen stores, right?
Mm-hmm.
We keep them as a reserve source of energy.
Mm-hmm.
But so that excess glucose that is not burned is converted to glycerol and then fat and pumped into fat cells by insulin. So excess carbohydrate in the diet produces fat in an obligatory sense, right? It doesn't have any other choice.
Right.
Metabolically, this is what must happen. And of course, as soon as that sugar is gone from your bloodstream, you become extremely hungry and you crave more of it. So you're constantly hungry and constantly eating more and more carbs. So it becomes a weight gain cycle. I mean, if you were to follow the food pyramid recommendation, you would become obese. There's just no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't eat 300 or 400 grams of carbohydrates a day and have a sedentary lifestyle and not gain weight. It's, you know, almost impossible. And one of the things that I found that I find fascinating is look at some movies from the 70s. I saw recently a YouTube video of a presentation of the Bach St. Matthew Passion, also recorded in 1970. Looking around the orchestra and the chorus, you couldn't find anybody who was obese. Right? Everybody was normal, slim-looking people.
Yeah.
Look at an old Dirty Harry movie from the 70s. Right? Mm-hmm. Everybody is like skinny, right? There is no obesity.
What a difference 20 or 25 years makes.
Yeah.
So,
amazing.
You know, this high hemoglobin A1C, we talked about last show, treating by the numbers and having
these things
pop up. How on earth did hemoglobin A1C become the barometer of diabetic diagnosis and control? I mean, everybody's being really put on metformin, everything, because their hemoglobin A1C, they're pre-diabetic because their hemoglobin A1C is whatever, but their blood sugar level is normal. What is up with that? Who came up with that?
Well, of course, it's pushed by industry. It's a secondary marker, right? It doesn't really correlate with real risk in terms of mortality. Hemoglobin A1C has, blood sugar control in general, has never been shown to be affected, shall we say. I mean, to affect levels of cardiovascular mortality or large vessel cardiovascular disease. And the evidence for microvascular disease is extremely weak. We're talking about relative risk differences of maybe 1% or 2%, depending on the study,
right,
in terms of incidence of retinopathy or incidence of proteinuria. So none of the real hard endpoints are affected by glycemic control. But this is, again, the model from type 1 diabetes being imposed on type 2 diabetes, when in fact they're radically different diseases. For those who are not aware in the audience, type 1 disease is a disease of insulin insufficiency, where your pancreas is being attacked by an autoimmune process and doesn't produce insulin adequately or at all. So there, the answer is a low-carb diet plus insulin. And, you know, the lower, the better your diet, the less insulin you need, which is good, right? That's also an extremely important part of the approach.
Mm-hmm.
In type 2 diabetes, this develops over many years, as I said, where you have central obesity, visceral fat increases, and you're producing ever greater amounts of insulin because the cells in your body resist the effect of insulin. And these adipocytes in the central body, central part of the abdomen, the visceral fat, produce various hormones and inflammatory mediators that are probably involved in the vascular aspect, the vascular disease of type 2 diabetes or metabolic syndrome. And this process is going on and on for years. And by the way, it's reversible, or at least can be stabilized by dietary change and weight loss. So this whole hemoglobin A1C, it's a convenient target that's being promoted as a way to push this idea that this is the approach. And of course, by treating hemoglobin A1C, it's going to involve more and more drugs. Start with metformin, then add, you know, a sulfonylurea,
mm-hmm.
which are not good drugs. Add insulin, ultimately. Insulin should almost never be used in type 2 diabetes, in my view. It almost always produces weight gain. And I believe many of the complications of type 2 diabetes are not so much from the hyperglycemia as from the high insulin levels. And once you start injecting insulin, your insulin levels go sky high. I mean, it's ridiculous.
So you like create a metabolic syndrome.
Failure of therapy when you start to push insulin for type 2 diabetes. That's a failure of therapy.
Interesting.
And an indication to to radically change diet to low carb so you'll be able to get off the insulin and you know, restore good health. It should be the goal, not just maintain a hemoglobin A1C below a certain number.
Oh, absolutely. I wanted to, well, just briefly, since you touched on these medications, what do you think about this Trulicity and all this other stuff that's injectable? What are those things? So they're not insulin per se, but you're supposed to be using them with your hypoglycemic, it just seems to me another moneymaker, but do you have any idea what those things actually do?
I've heard of Trulicity. I've never used it. You know, I do not use any of the newer drugs. I try to go drug-free as much as possible because I don't think they're proven. Or they don't have a track record. The only drug that has a good track record, in my view, for type 2 diabetes is metformin. And that I still recommend in early diabetics, trying to get them off of everything eventually,
right?
Diet. Another good approach to type 2 diabetes, which I think is showing promise, is the SGLT2 inhibitors, the glyphosins. And recently, this drug Jardiance, you know, showed slowing of renal disease, slowing of the course of renal disease. Now, this is not surprising to me, because the approach of this drug is it tricks the kidney into dumping sugar in the urine.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't add to your glucose burden, right?
Mm-hmm.
Virtually every other treatment, with the exception of metformin, works by either increasing insulin or overcoming barriers to insulin resistance. So you end up pushing more fat into your fat cells and you gain weight. So, you know, almost all the approaches to type 2 diabetes involve weight gain, with the exception of metformin and these new drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors, where you're dumping sugar in the urine. So, combination of a low-carb diet, metformin, and SGLT2 inhibitor should cure type 2 diabetes in a matter of 6 to 12 months if you really follow it.
And you can come off of them.
That's the approach that I take.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, and the newer drugs, you know, I think I just don't trust them. I don't trust the studies. You know, since the Avandia fiasco, where Avandia was shown to increase cardiovascular mortality, I decided at that point that this is a problem with all these drugs, because they all produce weight gain.
Yeah.
And if you produce weight gain, the drug simply should not be used, right? I mean, the disease is not hyperglycemia. The disease is metabolic syndrome, which is due to central obesity. So if your drug that you're treating it with increases central obesity, to me, that's an absolute contraindication to using it.
That's common sense.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about protein. In those high-protein diets, high-protein, high-fat diets, is that going to put you at risk for kidney disease if you don't drink enough water?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. The MDRD study, Modification of Diet and Renal Disease, which is the only really big controlled trial of protein reduction for treatment of chronic kidney disease, done in the 80s. While I was a fellow, this thing came out, was negative. It did not slow the progression of chronic kidney disease. And it was associated with development of low albumin levels and other indicators of protein malnutrition in some advanced populations. Of course, if you have even moderate chronic kidney disease, you don't really eat a lot of protein. Your appetite is affected. You don't eat a lot of protein. But that whole theory, I think, is just gone. You know, it's still widely out there in the collective unconsciousness of the, or consciousness of the, unconsciousness is probably a better idea, better word, of the population, that protein is somehow harmful for your kidneys. And I just don't buy it at all.
Well, that's good to know, because that's one of the major diets that work. I mean, what is it, the Atkins diet, where, you know, it's a low carb and it's usually high fat, high protein. I did it.
You know,
I felt great when I was on
protein.
It.
It doesn't have to be a 20-ounce steak every night. And I'm discovering that the diet should actually be isocaloric, meaning you keep the same number of total calories. You do that really by increasing fat as opposed to protein. And what I've discovered over the last few years is that not only is that not harmful, but it's beneficial. And you lose more weight and you get healthier eating fat. The body needs fat. I mean, there's just, you know, the brain is like 90% fat or whatever.
Yeah.
Myelin is all fat. I think we've made a colossal error in this low-fat recommendation, which is still extremely deeply ingrained in the collective unconsciousness.
It makes you wonder if the rise in dementia is also one of the side effects of this diet because of the low-fat.
Yeah, there are some very good articles looking at this that I can send to you. Very detailed, I mean, stuff that I was completely unaware of in terms of lipid transport into the brain, the dependency of the brain on good quality lipids getting into the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's extremely complicated and poorly understood, but some excellent stuff written about it, and I would not be surprised if the dementia epidemic is also related to this bad dietary advice and the epidemic of insulin resistance.
I wouldn't doubt it. Hey, in the last minute that we have left, how can people reach you? Are you writing a blog? Where can they see your work?
Not really. I mean, I've been publishing stuff on Facebook, and just my Richard Amerling MD Facebook page. I put up interesting articles. I may have to start to put out a blog again because I see that you know, it's needed. But I do recommend Werner's stuff for high quality information. Tim Noakes also, great stuff. There's a lot of information out there. It's not going to come via the mainstream press.
Oh, that's for sure.
It's not going to come by JAMA. You know, it's going to come through your doing the investigative work yourself. Unfortunately, the literature database is corrupted and heavily biased, and you're going to have to find the information yourself. And what I tell the students is don't neglect the basic sciences, because that really is the basis of it all.
I couldn't have said it better. You know, Richard, it's always a pleasure and a blessing having you on the show, because I think you just impart wisdom, and it's no drama, just the facts, and I love that. And I would love it if you can come back on in the future.
You bet, Elaine. A pleasure always.
Thank you for coming, and have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.